Hi, everyone. This past Monday was the first Monday in May. Yes, it was the Met Gala, or what many call fashion's Super Bowl. For fashion lawyers and scholars, the Met Gala often brings up many legal issues. It's what we might call a dream hypothetical. This year was no different. We had labor law issues. Employees of Condé Nast successfully used the Met Gala as leverage to negotiate their first union contract. There were, of course, the perpetual conflict of interest issues to resolve as trustees of the Met organize a party that has charitable goals, but which also creates marketing and advertising opportunities and an over 900 million media impact value. And let's not forget TikTok this year, which, as many outlets, including the Business of Fashion, reported, was both the event's sponsor and, according to legislators in D.C., a national security threat. Of course, there's a First Amendment issue, too, that will now be litigated. For me, the Met Gala always represents a great example of cultural heritage merging with fashion, and therefore the cross-pollination between cultural heritage law and fashion law. How do we see current fashion on the Met Gala red carpet as of cultural interest to us in comparison to works in the exhibit? How do we treat today's fashion in comparison to the fashion behind glass in a museum? Is there a difference between cultural property, museum quality, archival, and vintage on the Met Gala red carpet? The morning after the 2024 Met Gala, I had to talk to someone about my impressions. Thankfully, my colleague in Florence, with whom I also recently co-wrote an article on the Pucci archive, Lucrezia Palandri, was just as inundated with thoughts as I was and was up for a transatlantic aperitivo to discuss. A fashion and law scholar, Lucrezia is based between Florence and Como, where she now researches on fashion, tourism, and sustainability topics too at the Università dell'Insubria. As you'll hear from our enthusiastic conversation, Lucrezia and I were particularly struck by the archival reproductions we saw on the Met Gala red carpet. As fashion law scholars who are particularly interested in heritage issues, these reproductions raised our interest for two reasons. First, reproductions point to a specter of copyright protection. In the US, we extend copyright protection to an expression, not an idea, which remains in the public domain. So, particular drawings or appliques of flowers may be expressions and copyrightable subject matter. But the idea of a flower itself is freely available in the public domain. We also do not extend protection to the silhouette or form of a fashion design, although a fashion design might have conceptually separable elements that can be extended copyright protection if we imagine them apart from the dress and in another tangible medium of expression, like a canvas. Weren't the birds on Elle Fanning's dress, for example, particularly sculptural when imagined separately from the dress? Of course, if a brand is self-copying, there's likely no infringement. You'll allow yourself the privilege of copying your own work. When one brand is resurrecting copyrightable parts of another brand's fashion design, is when the conversation might get more complicated. How do you find out if you can reproduce a fashion design from a shuttered heritage brand whose archive may be dispersed? It might help if an heir of a fashion founder, who might have a legal say in whether the fashion design can be copied, plays a part in the creative process. The idea-expression dichotomy and the requirement of conceptual separability are not the only copyright points that might be relevant. Even if you can identify a pictorial or sculptural part of a dress that is conceptually separable and an expression, you need to ask, are these parts of the design original enough? This might be a low bar, but as Lucrezia and I have argued in our scholarly work, in cases where reproductions are taken from archives, comparisons with the original design in an archive might help to identify what we should really consider to be original additions in a reproduction. The pictorial and sculptural parts of fashion designs aren't the only parts of fashion that are susceptible to copyright law, of course. So are fashion photographs. When a celebrity helps to recreate a celebrated image, we might consider a new photograph to be substantially similar. But if economic compensation isn't the goal, if we all know the reference, and if an image is a cultural touchstone, How much importance should we assign to a copyright and to a possible copyright infringement? The second reason Lucrezia and I were taken by these reproductions is because they also point to a second specter, the possibility that heritage can be an extra legal framework that governs fashion presentations and copying outside of copyright law or even other IP rights. Talking about a brand's heritage, the purpose of a gown, the way it was made, or the layered cultural references within it might be just as or more important than thinking about the legal rights that apply to fashion. It's for this reason that my conversations with Lucrezia, both here and when we meet in Italy, are particularly interdisciplinary. With what better case study could we allow ourselves to let loose than the 2024 Met Gala and its Garden of Time? Hi, Lucrezia. How are you?
I'm good, Felicia. Thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm great post Met Gala viewing. And I think there's so much to talk about from a fashion law perspective.
Did you do like a marathon or something?
Yes, almost. I bounced around between like Ease coverage, live coverage, and the New York Times live blogging and what Vanessa Friedman had to say. Yeah. So I did a bit of bouncing. And of course, but I tried to stay away knowing that we were, of course, having our own fashion law in the Met Gala conversation today. Yes, let's just say it was a marathon. What about you? Are the images everywhere in Italy too?
Yeah, everywhere. I felt overwhelmed.
So what were your favorite looks? Knowing that, you know, you, like me, we look at these, you know, outfits from a fashion and law perspective, and we might pick up on things that I'm hoping some law students who are interested in fashion will be excited to hear, or maybe be thinking about themselves and then think, oh yes, other people saw that too, or I didn't spot that at all. So tell me, what were your favorite looks?
I noticed as first look, the Zendaya's one, or like the Zendaya's ones, because she had two different looks. And she was one of the co-chairs, as we know. I was very, very, as you, I know, I was very, very interested in the theme, in the dress code, this year's dress code. There was the Garden of Time, as you all know. And I didn't know the novel by Ballard that was inspired by the dress code, but I was very struck and very surprised because it's a theme. Like the novel is about this count and countess, and they are in this beautiful villa with this beautiful garden, and like a crowd is assaulting them. But the count grows this beautiful flower, this time flower that can stop time and preserve them from preserve this peaceful existence. But of course, the time flower gradually diminishes its power. And so the crowd is approaching fast.
Yeah, it's kind of Boccaccio plague.
Yes. First of all, it reminds me a lot about the Italian tradition, like medieval tradition. And also considering the imaginary that was very Boccaccio inspired, but also it actually contains all the themes that I'm interested in as a scholar, and you too, actually. So this idea of this human desire of preserving time, but also having to take into account the inevitability of change. And that's also can tell a lot about the function and role of fashion archives, like looking from our perspective. So we know that archives are not just dusty repositories, but they should have an active role, and they should be like living heritage, and the content should be reused and reworked. So I found this theme very inspiring. I also noticed that most of the celebrities actually interpreted it very literally, like with this aspect of the garden. So very flowery and blossoming.
That's so many flowers. Your point about the fashion archives is so on point, obviously, and also then makes me think, okay, well, when we apply the law to past fashions, or right, even to what's in an archive, how is it that the law facilitates the passing of time, preservation? You know, how is it that legal instruments can facilitate, you know, the notion of time that we want? And, you know, the flowers really made me think of, and I know, of course, you work in copyright too, so it made me think of this idea versus expression dichotomy, you know, and how we have this idea of the flower in the story that, you know, that we might have described in text, but may not necessarily have an image of it. And then we have all these different expressions of flowers on the specific dresses, either as appliques or, you know, within the dress itself. So yes to all of what you're saying.
Yeah. And just to circle back to my initial point, I just saw Zendaya's dresses as an example, like a beautiful example of this archival role, this use of archive dresses, archive material, as something that can be a living matter. That's interesting because her second look was a Galliano's look, but from Givenchy fashion house. And it's a look from 1996. So it's really an archival example. And the first look is a Margiela costume that was designed for her. But Galliano is the creative director, so stile Galliano. But so it's a new production, but Galliano already produced it in 1999 for Dior when he was creative director of Dior. But it was reproduced, redesigned, reproduced in a contemporary interpretation. So these are two different interpretations and aspects of what we were just saying. And then Zendaya is beautiful.
So statuesque.
Is her.
Yeah, she's so statuesque. No, I agree. I really appreciated so many of the reproductions and reinterpretations, like what you're mentioning with the Margiela look. I mean, for me, the number one look was Nicole Kidman's Balenciaga.
Yeah, that was my second choice.
I liked that Zendaya was reported as having bought the Givenchy look that she wore last, which for me, again, like you, from this fashion archives perspective, I thought, oh, this is really great from a property and ownership perspective, because you know, unlike Kim Kardashian wearing Marilyn Monroe's dress, and then people saying, oh, it's in Ripley's, is that a museum or not? Is that proper? This, you know, Zendaya bought it and she owns it. And so it's a lot like Nicole Kidman wearing the Chanel gown that Karl Lagerfeld, you know, designed for her for the Chanel No. 5 commercial last year. It's this connection to a personal archive kind of outside of a museum space, but maybe not yet in the cultural interest box that we would think of with cultural property. So I thought that was really interesting. But I loved Nicole Kidman's dress, and I loved the way she talked about it. And from the copying perspective, it was so interesting to me because that was a 1951 Balenciaga gown that was so true to the original. So when I was looking at it and I was thinking about it, I thought, okay, well, here you've got a really easy, if you will, legal issue, because it's already in your archive. You're copying it, you're reproducing it, you're putting it on, you know, Nicole Kidman. There is a photograph that inspires it, but, you know, that's separate. And of course, the poses that Nicole Kidman was doing on the red carpet is just the pose, right? The form. And she clearly was very clear about that it was inspired by the photograph. Yeah. So that was an interesting component to it as well. So I don't know if that original 1951 gown is in the Balenciaga Museum or in the archives.
I just read somewhere that now it's housed in a museum in Philadelphia.
Okay, great.
I mean, I'm not sure about the source. It's an online source, like an overnight source.
Less than 24 hours to prepare for this episode. That's great. Okay, an excuse for you and I to travel to Philly and see this drastic
story. Yeah.
Did you see Isabelle Huppert's dress? Hubert, did you see her dress?
I didn't. I missed it.
Oh my gosh. Okay, this was another really great dress. So
I'm Googling it now.
Yeah. Okay, so this dress, so I saw it and I read that it was also by Balenciaga, but it was a recreation of a Calosseur dress. And you know, so I started thinking from a legal perspective, I'm like, okay, this is very interesting. Calosseur, you know, closed in 1948. Of course, they were a huge brand in the early 20th century to the 20s. In fact, Hortense Acton, who owned Villa La Pietra in Florence, had a number of Calosseur gowns, which are all still preserved at Villa La Pietra. So I thought, okay, from like a copyright perspective, if there were even a copyright in this design, and obviously we probably would be thinking of French law, which is more, you know, permissive or broad, you know, it would be interesting to see who kind of had inherited the IP right there, if there were any, right? If there were any, but because no one bought the house after it closed. But then I read that Isabelle Huppert is actually the great granddaughter of one of the four sisters who founded Calosseur. So I thought, this is great because, you know, you can inherit copyright, you can assign it before the term expires. And wow. So you have this, yeah, you have this personal connection that's interesting from a personal view, but also, if you will, from a potentially like legal perspective. And also what was really cool too is that Balenciaga made additions to the dress, like the turtleneck and other aspects of it, for Isabelle Huppert. And the dress, the original Calosseur dress, is on display in the Sleeping Beauties exhibit because it was worn by a woman in the 1930s who then they actually recreated through AI in the exhibit, so you can ask her questions about what it was like to wear this 1930s evening dress. And of course, I have not obviously visited the exhibit yet. So that was the other dress that, for me, from like a fashion law and heritage perspective and archives, I thought, wow, this dress is just hitting all the points for me. And of course, you had like the intangible versus tangible, you know, the physical tangible dress that obviously is of such cultural interest in the exhibit, but then taking the intangible parts of it, the design, and recreating it. So that hit a lot of the legal notes, if you will, for me too. But
yeah.
You saw it. Did you see a picture of it?
Yeah, I was just going through the pictures. That's also beautiful. Yeah. I opened a bracket and I just saw her in a piece in theater in Milan.
Oh, that's
by Romeo Castellucci, and the costumes were stunning. By the way, it was this sort of monologue and amazing. So,
oh, how beautiful! How wonderful that you saw her in person. She looks like she just, you know, radiates this presence.
She does definitely. Yeah, she was beautiful.
Yeah, that's also why I'm so happy to be having this conversation with you, because, of course, you're not just a legal scholar, but you're a contemporary dancer yourself, a modern dance artist. So,
I am. I know. I also, you mentioned the exhibition, like the Sleeping Beauties, and the extensive use they made of AI and tech elements in general. I was thinking about the role of technology, like related to fashion archives and dresses that are dormant, that are resting, because are too fragile to be worn. So in this perspective, I saw Kendall Jenner's dress.
Yes.
And that's kind of an example of a reverse case, because she wore a dress from the Alexander McQueen's archive. And this dress was presented 25 years ago and was presented on a robo mannequin. never on a model or on a physical person. And then this dress was just boxed up and stored in the archive. And now Kendall Jenner's just wore it. So this idea of retrieving archival look, whose initial presentation was actually through technology. It's actually incredibly matching the theme of the night, I would say. I mentioned Alexander McQueen, I just wanted to share another case, the Lana Del Rey's dress. That's,
I don't know. What did we think?
I'm going out of the topic of your question, because I'm thinking that I thought, wear the original next time, Lana, please. No, because you know that was a reproduction of an original design by Alexander McQueen, like a beautiful original design. I went to see it, and it's, I think, from a fall collection, 2006-2007. And the name of the dress was Widows of Culloden. So something very dramatic. But the new creative director, he just decided to actually celebrate the heritage of the brand, but interpreting it in a contemporary way, and so redesigned the original dress. And yeah, the result is not quite the best, because here we are also interested in this process. We also came up with the name of that, this
heritage shaking
process. I'm just self quoting.
Self-promoting, yes. If you're listening and you're interested in this, we have an article. Lucrezia and I have a co-authored article on this. We have this idea of heritage shaking, reinterpreting designs from an archive. So some shameless self-promotion going on here.
Yeah, exactly. Just subtle promotion. Yeah.
Important. But I agree with you. I mean, so when I saw that on Lana Del Rey, I thought, okay, I can see the thorns.
Yeah.
So like the thorns in the garden, right, from the Garden of Time short story. I didn't think it really worked from an aesthetic standpoint. It also, you know, it kind of looked like it was in the middle, you know, and that's interesting for us for an interpretive standpoint in terms of creating derivative works from the IP in the archive. It didn't seem to me, to use our language from our article, it didn't seem to me to move the reference forward enough. You know, you and I think a lot about that article, Angelo Flaccavento in Invisible Fashion. This idea of, you know, moving the reference forward. I mean, it seemed like it was kind of in the in-between, which at times, when you have a new creative director, you know, that they're kind of finding their footing. And so it's not necessarily something that you would consider original enough from the first iteration in the archive. So I agree. Another dress that I was kind of on the fence was the one that Chloe Sevigny wore. So Chloe Sevigny wore this dress that was made from three antique Victorian dresses sewn together. And the aesthetic of the dress, I thought, could work. I mean, I heard some people kind of in the commentary universe say, oh, well, you know, the corset isn't really sewn properly, or, you know, but I mean, apart from that, for me, I thought this brings up an issue of, well, when do we decide to upcycle and destroy or rework a past tangible item into a new creation and add this cultural interest to it in a different way? And when do we decide, okay, you know, we're not touching the original textiles and we're leaving them that way because we think they're of cultural interest, you know, in and of themselves. And this brings up a lot of issues with, you know, cultural property and destruction, but also just the idea, you know, now we talk so much about upcycling and brands can get very testy about when, you know, their logos or on textile are made into, you know, different products. But here we didn't have any logos necessarily. It was just, you know, a piece of historic fabric. Mm-hmm. But I think some of the same questions remain just in terms of the integrity of the fabric and of the textile.
Yeah, definitely. I think that I also read a lot, even in the Italian press, about this, of course, the choice of celebrities, the increasing trend of celebrities' choices towards the archives or fashion archives for a number of reasons. But there is also this problem of touching historical pieces, historical garments, historical fabric. And these clothes, this fabric are delicate, are fragile, and most of the time, if any alteration is needed, they will be damaged. And as we also remember from the Kim Kardashian's case, probably what's the proper balancing of interests? It's a delicate question. Also, fashion houses, fashion archives are appreciating this trend because it has different advantages, different benefits for them. I also read, I don't know if it was Vanessa Friedman or someone else these days that was also saying that it also, this trend also relieves fashion houses from the pressure of creating new clothes while they're maybe working on other collections or fashion shows. It gives a boost to their archives, as we know. It also gives a sort of environmental credit. If we think about it, most of the time it's tokenism, but it's actually something that's really promoting their reputation and sustainability, environmental impact is crucial nowadays. So that's also an extra benefit that fashion archives can have. So there are different interests, different benefits and pros and cons. So it's always a matter of balancing in a case by case. It's something that we know as lawyers that the solution lies most of the time in a tailor-made solution or ad hoc principles that are elaborated according to factual circumstances on a case-by-case decision-making process.
So. Oh, completely. And strategically. Yeah, I think brands are very strategic now. And I think an event like the Met Gala always brings this home to me about, as you mentioned, with upcycling and, you know, creating products that have material differences. I mean, when third parties do that, and brands really desire to get into the resale market now and, you know, the vintage market. I mean, this is also a way of strategically creating benefit that is not about going after infringers necessarily, but it's very much about promoting. We created this object from the past. Now, you know, you can buy through property law, right? The same thing. We want to encourage some, you know, uses of our raw material, so to speak, but we want to discourage others. It's about finding the balance of which uses benefit us and which uses don't. Allowing, for example, Zendaya to buy, right? I mean, and of course she can, but you could imagine, you know, with the relationships in the fashion industry, you could imagine Givenchy saying, you know, oh, we would really love to have that in our archive. Mm. But, you know, Zendaya buys it. I read, you know, and I think it was Vanessa Friedman too, saying this was a statement, you know, that this was Zendaya wasn't pointing to a brand, but she was pointing to herself. as kind of the reference point. And that's another thing, of course, that brands have to balance, because you want an independent celebrity who has their own power to collaborate, you know, with your brand. I mean, I thought a lot of the celebrities that were dressed in Loewe showed that a lot, you know, really like one of the stars of The Bear, you know, really like actresses and celebrities that are up and coming. But at the same time, you know, you have to balance that with, oh, we would like to have things in our archive, but we recognize that some celebrities will create their own archive. And so how do we create that balance? And, you know, be very smart about the rights we have. And just because you have a legal right doesn't mean all the time that you want to enforce it. You can get, you know, the benefit in another way. And that's really where, and I think you and I are on the same page with this, or we both enjoy exploring this question. That's where heritage really can be this extra legal framework. We're talking about heritage, promoting heritage, creating events like the Met Gala, which we haven't even gotten to talking about, you know, and that might be for a total other episode about how, you know, Vogue and Condé Nast in some ways does benefit, right? Even though, of course, it has a charitable purpose, but there is some benefit to be had there between the live stream and the photographs and the special issues of
exclusive content.
Exclusive content. By the way, collab with TikTok. I went on TikTok this morning. I thought, oh, how nice. There's a dedicated channel, TikTok and Vogue, with both their trademarks right there on the channel. Yeah.
Here's the figure, like the main figure, like of Anne Wintour. She's both the creative director, the editor-in-chief of Vogue, and also the editorial director of Condé Nast, and also the chair of the Met Gala, and so on and so forth.
And of course, we have like ethical rules to, you know, to balance those different roles and to make sure there are no conflicts of interest. And it can all work, as it does beautifully at the Met Gala often. But it's, you know, it's important to kind of be transparent about how this gray area in which we operate, where the law certainly is a tool, but it's not your only tool.
There's a lot to do with extra legal concepts, like ethical considerations. So we like to look at law with a broadened perspective. That's not only like a crossing geographical boundaries, because we both have a comparative perspective. So we most of the time, I mean, we always look at issues from a dual, at least, viewpoint, like the US and Italy, but also like a methodological comparative method. So using this broader perspective, these lenses from different areas, different disciplines, and considering law not only as a list of regulations, but having in mind this idea of detecting rights and interests, and considering how to balance them, and what are the different factors, ethical, social, cultural. We both taught a lot to students, and I also like to repeat that, because most students are not law students. Sometimes they are design students, they are art students, and they think that law is boring. But if you have these lenses that you can watch through different topics with this idea of protection, and what's the most suitable protection to some concrete cases, that's different. And we can also go and talk about Met Gala, even if we are lawyers.
Of course. Our case study, you know, par excellence. Yes, the law is not boring. Right. No, exactly. So I would like to see an Italian Met Gala at the new Palazzo Pitti. So I would really like.
I don't know about the the money that we could spend on that, I think Italians will be immediately complaining about the $50,000 ticket.
No, $75,000 ticket, right? Okay, so that, yeah, it's increased, but that might be so. But look at all the Italian brands that, like, Margiela is owned by Diesel.
Yeah.
By OTB, I think we should think about, it would be cool. It would be very cool to see. If I went to one, I'd love to walk up with an ice cube bag myself. And then you and I could have a whole other conversation about whether it's fixed enough for US law and for Italian law as a work of conceptual art or as a bag. So.
Yeah. Is it original enough? It has artistic nature or not?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, Lucrezia, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much, as always. And maybe we'll have to make this an annual thing for the Met Gala.
Yeah, you always have the best ideas. So,
Vogue has imagined Vogue World in fashion cities from New York to London and Paris. Is it too much to imagine a Met Gala gone global? I hope not. There are so many fashion collections to support in the world. I hope Lucrezia and I manifested some sort of Italian Met Gala in the future. There are also so many issues we did not discuss in our conversation. Consider how so many commentators at the Met Gala noted the hours it took the artisans in these fashion houses to create the looks we saw on the Met Gala carpet. That traditional craftsmanship and artisanship seems to be a manifestation of intangible cultural heritage. Mona Patel's dress, made by Iris van Erpen, with its moving flowers, pointed both to the riches of artisanship in India and its jewels, and to IP. Could those kinetic flowers, imagined with the help of an artist, be subject to a utility patent in addition to a copyright? Lucrezia and I might indeed just have to make this Met Gala theme an annual fashion law dinner party. I hope you've enjoyed this special episode, and I hope you'll join me as a guest for upcoming fashion law dinner parties.